friends. Next week will be the last telecast of the series. I was reminded of that just the other day. I tried to get into a telephone booth. As I was waiting, a young woman opened the door, and she said, I won't be long. I just want to hang up on him. So we're hanging up next week. And I asked the angel what he wanted to do during the hot summer months. And he said he wanted to be a rear admiral. So I'm going to let him stand in the back of an admiral refrigerator during the summer. We received an interesting letter from a mother in Cincinnati who told us about her daughter, Patricia. And she was downtown, this six-year-old daughter. And she said, oh, Mother, today is Bishop Sheen's birthday. Well, how do you know it's Bishop Sheen's birthday? Well, she said, look at all the flags with the crosses on them. They're out for him. They happen to be Red Cross flags. Well, Patricia, I have a birthday in May, but I want to tell you that the difference between a man and a woman having a birthday is that the man always takes the day off on his birthday. A woman takes a year off. Our subject tonight is the Russian lullaby of coexistence. And I want to assure you that it is such a terrible lullaby that it would be well for the Western world to pretend that it's asleep. Now, what is coexistence? Well, can you imagine some young man, tall, dark, and has some money, and he's courting this young lady, has a ring in his hand, he's just about to propose, and he proposes to her in these words. Would you coexist with me until the sands of the desert grow cold? Now, certainly she would know there was not very much love there. And there never is any love and any justice where there is mere coexistence. Coexistence is for couples who are incompatible. When the husband loses his income, the wife loses her patibility. And that was kind of slow, Fred. And just imagine somebody came to you seeking lodgings. And he had a number of letters of recommendation that he was a man of peace and believed in coexistence. And he had letters from 418 professors, all professional signers, too. And letters from a few ex-officials of the State Department and two or three scientists all recommending him. And then you make an investigation to find out if he's really a man of peace. And you make inquiries where he lived before. And you go down a one block and you find out that there are a number of houses. These are houses. Aren't you glad I told you? And as you make an investigation, you find out that here he violated the daughter of the house. Here he stole the wife. Here he kidnapped the baby. And here he stole the jewels. And in each and every instance, he said that he was liberating the daughter, the wife, the baby, and the jewels. Well, you would question whether or not he was a man of peace. Now then, suppose Soviet Russia comes to us, pleads for coexistence. Well, we must not listen to the talk or letters of recommendation. We must find out how Russia's lived in the past. Now, here are just some promises of coexistence, which we will look at very quickly. There are many others, but we have to pass them over. In 1926, there was a Lithuanian non-aggression pact with the Soviets. They promised peaceful coexistence. In 1940, the Soviets annexed Lithuania, called it liberation. In 1932, coexistence, non-aggression pact with Latvia. 1940, annex Latvia. 1932, Polish non-aggression pact of coexistence. 1939, seize Poland. 1939, peaceful coexistence with Estonia. 1939, seized it. 1933, Litvinov agreement. Litvinov promised President Roosevelt that the Soviets would not start any communist parties in the United States. 1934, they began infiltrating into the government. So that we should ask ourselves, if they are really sincere, are we as naive as the woman who thinks she looks as beautiful as other women say she looks? Have we forgotten that as people lose faith, they begin to put their trust in staffs that pierce their hands? Remember the old fable of the wolf and the lamb. The wolf promised coexistence with the lamb and said, I will be good to you. And coexistence ended in uni existence as the wolf swallowed the lamb. And that's the meaning of communist coexistence, uni existence, existence only for the Soviets. I know the answer of those who say that, well, all this is past. And we must remake a new world. All this is water under the bridge. Let's not cry over spilt milk. Very well. Let's not cry over spilt milk, but let's find out who's breaking the jugs. And certainly throughout the world, the Soviets are doing that. Now that brings up the question. Why do they want coexistence? Why do some in America want it? First of all, why do they want it? Here is a very interesting statement of Stalin. It was made 1927. We cannot forget the saying of Lenin to the effect that a great deal depends on whether we succeed in delaying the war with the capitalistic country, which is inevitable. It may be delayed either, one, until the proletariat revolution ripens in Europe, two, until colonial revolutions come fully to a head, three, until the capitalistic countries fight among themselves over the division of the colonies. Therefore, the maintenance of peaceful relations with capitalistic countries is an obligatory task for us. The basis of our relations with capitalistic countries consists in admitting the coexistence of two opposed systems. In other words, coexistence until they can take over the world. Now let us see why coexistence is wanted. Not because we believe in peace rooted in justice. The foundation of the desire for coexistence is fear. On the part of America, that fear is physical and psychological. On the part of the Soviets, that fear is physical alone, not psychological. Now let us analyze that. We want harmony, we want peace, simply because we are human beings, we are not imperialistic. We want to live in concord with ourselves and with the world, but also because we fear the terrible effects of a Third World War. I need not develop that any further. That is very obvious. So let us pass on to psychological fear. In addition to this dread that all of us have of an atomic warfare, with the possible effect of creating the next generation of neurotics. In addition to that, we are living in psychological fear. Sometimes the way newscasts are given, the way news is presented, is to heighten our fear. And then in addition to that, though these are trivial things, nevertheless the cumulative effect is great. So that we're constantly reading and hearing over the radio and television and seeing in the press such warnings as these. Have you looked at your toothbrush lately? Are you only 3/4 safe? Do you not realize that you may be socially ostracized? That there's a terrible penalty in America of social non-acceptance? How would you dare go out to a party with dishpan hands? Shame, oh shame on you American women. Be fearful of this. And then in addition to that, young husbands, as you go to work, you're fearful of your job, fearful of security. You know not what your boss will say to you. Look at your shirt, that tattletale gray. Fear ye not the economic consequences of this. Are you sneezing when you use soap? Are you sure that you have washed all the germs off your body? Be sure to use something that has in it the occipital frontalis and the convolutional convolution to the metaphorical obliqui arm, pelvic arm. Then you're safe. Are you not attending the best clubs? Are you not invited to the best parties? Are you just an average citizen? Why are you not a man of extinction? Are you not fearful? Take up the glass of Guzzler's gin. Otherwise, fear for your future. Oh, I know these things are light, but do you ever advert to it? That it's fear, 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 and only a fear of the things of body germs. No fear of anything. The more serious point of the two, of course, is the fear of non-survival on our part. Now we come to why the Soviets want coexistence. There's a new reason being given. Two articles appeared in Soviet literature within the past year. One article appeared March 1954 in the Bolshevik, written by I.A. Selechnyak, in which the author, in the article entitled Some Problems of Philosophy, repudiates, in double talk, of course, a basic principle of Marxist philosophy. Now, permit me to become technical for a moment. The basic principle of Marxist philosophy is that there is in nature and in history a law which the communists say is bound to work itself out. That law is that there is bound to be an increasing tension between capital and labor. That tension increases and mounts until finally there is a communist revolution when the property is taken over by the socialistic state under the communists. In this article of Selechnyak, he says that law is not working out as we expected. Capitalism of the Western world is not decaying. Communism is going to have a slow birth in the Western world. And then he says, and so we must have, for more or less long historical periods, coexistence with the capitalistic nations. That is not all. A more interesting article still appears in the Communist, October 1954. Now, these are Soviet publications. This article was written by A. Leontiev, entitled The Peaceful Coexistence of Two Systems, which was taken from that speech of Stalin. And in this article, Leontiev says, We cannot look for the decay of capitalism immediately. Then, he goes back to another principle of Marx and of Hegel. And this principle, which is underneath all communist revolution, is this. The greatest progress that is ever made in history is made through the greatest acts of violence. But the greatest act of violence is the communist revolution. Therefore, it produces, say the communists, the greatest progress, namely, communism. The I writer continues. He says, we can no longer depend upon the operation of this law because with the atomic bomb, there is now a greater violence possible than the communist revolution. And that violence is possible through atomic energy and its explosive forces. And that atomic violence is in the hands of the enemy as well as in our own hands. Therefore, we must have coexistence. And to what end and purpose? So they can go on nibbling and nibbling away at Korea, Vietnam, China, next Burma, India, and Africa, and the rest of the world. The fear of the atomic bomb on Russia's part and on ours. Why this is peculiar. It's very much like, for example, a husband and a wife fighting, and they've not yet started throwing things. She's got a Ming vase in her hand, and he's got a niblick, a fine golf club of his, and they're both afraid to throw, afraid they'll risk what they love. Very much like, for example, Uncle Sam and nephew Khrushchev going to bed in the United Nations building. Pals, coexistence. They're afraid to go to bed. Each one is afraid to go to bed first. He can't trust the other man. So they stay up half the night, and they get so tired, they retire together. And then Uncle Sam says, good night, Nephew Khrushchev. And Nephew Khrushchev says, good night, Uncle Sam. And then they turn over and look under their pillows to see if the guns are loaded. Why, this fear is no basis for peace, unless it be ice peace. Not cold peace, it's ice peace. Ice peace because it's brittle. Ice peace because it involves cold looks on either side. And ice peace because it can quickly go to pieces. This is not the kind of peace that we want that is born of this fear. But it may be argued, as Churchill argued, that maybe the fear of the atomic bomb would bring us peace. Oh, let us not be so foolish as to think that. Churchill says, when we have reached a point where destructive weapons can kill everybody else, then nobody will want to kill anybody else. That is not true. Let it be recalled that that's precisely what the world said when dynamite was invented. They said exactly the same thing when the Maxim silencer and gun came into war. There'd be no more wars. Now they're saying it about the atomic bomb. Why, the very violence of atomic energy could inspire some nations to use it in the hope of bringing the war quickly to an end. There's only one force that can ever stop it. And that is a spiritual and moral force. Is there any hope then for peace? Well, we have to begin thinking about peace in a different way. Sure, there's hope. This is the way we think of peace at the present time. We think of peace like a pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid is the United Nations and the other nations of the world. And they sign treaties of peace and coexistence. And when they pour this oil out of the pitcher of coexistence, then it finally dribbles down the side of the pyramid, down to the millions and millions of individuals. And then we have world peace. That's not the way peace is made. Peace does not come from above. Peace is more like a tree. And the roots are many. Millions and millions of roots absorbing moisture from the earth and also the chemicals. And these millions and millions of roots are the people who have peace and righteousness in their own souls. And the branches are in communion with something invisible, namely the light of the heavens. Therefore, if there is to be true peace, There must be a fear, but a different kind of fear. The only kind of fear we have known up to the present time is what is known as a servile fear. Let it be known that there are two kinds of fear. There is the servile fear, such as a slave has for a tyrant, such as any of the citizens of the Soviet Republic have for the temporary captain and chief, Volgin. Then, in addition to that, there is filial fear. Filial fear is the kind of fear, for example, that a loving child has for a devoted father. The kind of fear that any of us would have who try to serve and love God. We are not afraid of His laws, not afraid of chastisement. It's just simply we obey the laws because we would not want to hurt anyone that we love. Anyone that's ever had love in his heart understands this filial fear, which is truly a kind of reverence. And if then there is to be peace, it will not be through servile fear of just atomic weapons. It will come through a filial fear in which we will begin to have reverence in this country. Reverence for the things of morality and decency and justice. All of our present fears are on the outside of us. Believe me, when a man and when a nation ceases to fear God with a filial fear, he then begins to fear his fellow man. And instead of fearing germs, instead of fearing enemies that are without, why not begin to fear ourselves? Fear God. Are we living as we should? In accordance with the great traditions of our country, filial fear that will restore into America the sanctity of the home and a reverence for marriages, so that when people pledge themselves to one another, they will keep it, and then nations will keep their pledges with one another. Filial fear among children so that they will love their parents, be brought up with respect and obedience to the fourth commandment. Filial fear among our statesmen so that they will not no longer be timid. Have we really arrived at a point where we have lost the capacity for moral indignation? Let us then not fear the things that are outside. Rather fear whether or not we are serving God. And if we have this fear in our heart, then we may not fear anyone else. For we will then have a security. We will then have a strength. We will then have a power which is greater than that of arms or bombs. For if God is with us, then who dare be against us?